Welcome to the award-winning Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100-degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Could I just take a moment to thank Cooker? When I go into podcasting, it was to produce a product that wasn't about making money or winning awards. I'll get back to that in a minute. It was about having autonomy and trying to make some content, which was different to radio and TV. That's what I think podcasts is. So it's like long form interviews and knowledge, entertainment, whatever we decide to put on these podcasts. But Cooker have just enabled me to keep going, and they pay for a few things I need to keep going. And I love doing this podcast. I love learning. Thank you so much for all the emails that have been sent recently. I did ask you for them. I did ask to see if people were enjoying the podcast, and you did send them in. Thank you very much. You should never look for external validation. I've learned that in my journey through why I have dark thoughts and I have depression sometimes. And, you know, you've got to look for internal validation. But there you go. I did ask and I got it. And I wanted to make sure I was still doing what people wanted to hear, because you can get caught up in your own ego, I suppose. Anyway, I got an email the other day from someone who said they'd never written to anyone before and it meant so much. I mean, they did say the podcast was shit, but they said they'd never written to anyone before. They didn't really. They said it was great and it kept them company, which was important to hear. If you are getting your kitchen done up, I can recommend Cooker Taps. They, I can't recommend them enough, actually. They're just brilliant. I mean, I can't imagine not having one now. I've had one for so long. As you know, mine does 100 degree boiling hot water. It does filtered water. It does filtered sparkling water, blah, blah, blah. Just a fantastic gadget. So I really recommend it. Go to cooker.co.uk. Awards are everything podcasts shouldn't be in my mind. There, I said it. I'm asked to enter every year the podcast awards. And there used to be two or three knocking about. I think one has now just come to the top. But I always say no, because I don't understand why competition podcasts are in competition with each other. Why does everything have to be a bloody competition? You know, I'm better than you. My podcast is better than you. Surely if you're judging it on which one's better, it's the only way to do it is who's got the most listeners. But then again, some of the ones with huge listenership, I just have no interest in. So anyway, thing about podcasts, there's no gatekeepers with podcasts. So I don't understand why you're trying to win something. You can't get a better slot because you just put it out there and people listen to it or they don't. And I mean, I suppose what it is good for is if you're trying to take it on the road, you're trying to attract a new sponsor in, more money. I mean, maybe trying to get on the BBC because, you know, the BBC Sounds podcasts always do amazingly well. And I suppose if you are on BBC Sounds, you want to win one so that then you do have gatekeepers because they select the podcast to go on. But maybe if you want to sign up to a big company and you've won an award and you want to try and do it that way, I don't know. I don't blame podcasters for entering, by the way. There's a real desire to be good and win things, you know, get credit for your work. It's important. External validation. That's not what I got into podcasting for. I started with Mark, and Mark's doing podcasting. I'm doing podcasting. We do them together every now and then. And we just got into it because we just wanted autonomy. We wanted to do our own stuff, put it out there and see if people listen to it. Thankfully, people do listen to this podcast. So thank you very much. And what they should do, by the way, if you listen to other podcasts, just write to them and tell them to give themselves an award. That's why I've been doing it for years. I used to I gave myself 6 awards on Soccer AM. No one knows. Just do it. As long as you go through a process, and I always do, I line all the podcasts up, think about it, and then give myself one because I think I'm the best. You know, it's just, and it is self-validation. So, so it's exactly what you should be doing. Anyway, the one thing I do hate about awards is I really hate seeing podcasters, I know, begging for votes. For fuck's sake, get a grip. You know, you don't need to do that. Your podcasts are great. I hate broadcasters begging for votes. We sometimes have to do it on TV. I hate it. Please, please like me. I mean, I think it's great for them to do. Don't get me wrong. I don't have any qualms about people getting awards. I feel uncomfortable for me to do it. Anyway, I don't need an award for doing my job. That is what I've decided. But getting emails telling me you're enjoying the podcast, telling me I'm wonderful. I do love that. It means so much more to me than getting a bloody medal. Lovejoyhour@gmail.com is where to send them if you do fancy. Well, you can tell me I'm crap. Either way, don't mind. But then if you think I'm crap, you're probably not listening to this. So a book arrived in the post the other day. Do We Have to Work by Matthew Taylor. I couldn't resist it even before I opened it. But when I did start reading it, wow, that's all I said. Wow. I hadn't thought about work at all. I hadn't thought about what it is. It's fascinating. So let me tell you a bit about Matthew, first of all, and then we'll get to speak to him. Matthew Taylor is chief executive of the NHS Confederation. Prior to that, he was 15 years chief executive of the RSA, a 250-year-old British institution devoted to enriching society through ideas and action to deliver a 21st century enlightenment. Wow, I think we're going to have to find out about the RSA to begin with, because that sounds interesting. 250-year-old, find out all about that. Anyway, Do We Have to Work? Let's find out. Here's Matthew. Matthew, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast today. I thoroughly enjoyed your book, Do We Have to Work? But before we get into that, in your intro, I said that you spent 15 years working at the RSA, a 250-year-old British institution. I'm a little bit ignorant to what it is. So could you explain what it was or what it is? Sorry.
Yeah, it stands for the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures and Commerce. So the RSA began 260 odd years ago, a group of people meeting in a coffee house in the Strand at the dawning of industrialization, post-enlightenment, a group of people who wanted to make the world a better place, really, and who felt that, I guess, that there was change happening, but society wasn't keeping up with it. So they started by commissioning prizes for people who would solve problems, anything from stop a new device so that you could clean your chimney without sending kids up it, or new social innovations like the first public toilets. So they had prizes and people sent things, they had awards, people sent things in and won prizes. They then extended that to arts as well. And it did that for 100 or so years. Then it became a bit more of a kind of learned society, people giving lectures, started to recruit fellows who would go to these lectures and talk about them. When I took it over, it was fine, but it was a bit of an old boys club, and we had 27,000 fellows, and the organization kind of was there to serve them. Now, my whole life has been about change, and I thought we should be doing more. So over those 15 years, I hope the organization became much more kind of impactful and high profile. And what it is today is, from the beautiful headquarters of the organization, which just off the Strand, one of the oldest organizations in the world, still in the headquarters built for it. It has an events program, and all that content is captured online, and they do really great things with it, animates, minimates, you know, various ways of presenting really interesting ideas from the best thinkers in the world. And some of that stuff's being watched by millions of people around the world. It then has a kind of think tank element, which is people working on change projects in areas ranging from climate change, public services, the future of work. One of the reasons I kind of got into that area, how do we improve work? And then finally, we have 31,000 fellows. And they are all kind of social entrepreneurs. They're all people trying to make a difference. So we support them in their local community, their professions, their areas of interest. And there are loads and loads of things in society which started up from a group of fellows getting together, the RSA offering them some support, and they've created a charity, a social enterprise, or whatever. So, you know, it's a great organization, difficult to get your head around. It's one of those organizations that people associated with it love it, and most other people don't know what it is.
Is it frustrating that when you're organizing something like that, that you look at the politicians and they are so far removed from long-term thinking, because it's just for them, it's about power and staying in government?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not cynical towards politicians. I used to work for Tony Blair in Downing Street, and I've, you know, been around politics and policy all my life. I think most politicians get into it because they want to make a difference. The problem is we get the politicians we deserve. And, you know, on the one hand, there's a 24-hour media that puts constant pressure on politicians to have to respond to everything in immediate terms. And secondly, we as citizens, we kind of, as a friend of mine who's does more polling than anybody else I know says, the thing about the British people, they're very clear what they want. They want Swedish welfare on American taxes. So we kind of ask, you know, we make demands on politicians. It's hard for them to fulfill. And what we need is politicians with emotional intelligence, actually, who can kind of engage us and say, look, I know what you want, but that's not what's going to happen. So what we need to do is government needs to work with citizens, with civil society, with business to try and solve problems together. And, you know, although I'm not a fan of Boris Johnson, you know, I'm you know, Labour person all my life, and I think he's got a lot of issues with Boris. The thing you've got to recognise about him is he does have that kind of capacity to connect with people. And I think that's critical for politicians. And, you know, we're talking just after he's made this really big speech about climate change. So, you know, when Boris supports things I don't support, like Brexit, I can't tell you how angry it makes me. But when he does support things that I care about, like tackling climate change, I think he's a pretty powerful advocate. So
this is going down a route I didn't want it to go down or expect it to go down. However, I will say that interviewing Jamie Lang, I don't know if you're aware of him from Made in Chelsea. He went to boarding school and he's been on my podcast. And he says the one thing that boarding school does and private education at that level does is it teaches you how to communicate and it gives you confidence. And I think this is a real problem we've got in politics is all the people who come out who can just stand there, Jacob Rees-Mogg, you know, David Cameron, they've all gone to these elite institutions where every week they've made to stand up and speak in front of people. So you have this belief that they know more than the people who struggle with that. Yet we know for a fact that there's very smart people out there who don't like standing up in front of people. That cannot be the only qualification for being a politician, because you've got to look at their morals as well and everything else which comes with it.
Yeah, I mean, a few years ago, I'd kind of tried to develop a grand theory of everything. And my grand theory of everything was that nearly all of our existence on Earth, we've been a particular kind of person and we lived in a particular kind of context. And then there's an amazing future which could be there for us. But at the moment, we're stuck in between. And I thought of this in terms of three areas. So we and I'll come to the politics point at the end, but we evolved in small groups of people just like us. The future we want is a world of massive connection and diversity. But at the moment, we're kind of stuck because we've got brains that evolved to like people who are like us and be suspicious of people who aren't like us. And we're trying to live in a diverse, fast-changing world. And we've got to work to get to be the kind of people who can flourish in diversity. And secondly, we developed and evolved in a time of scarcity. There wasn't enough of anything. And so if there was any food, we would eat it as quickly as we could or whatever. We now in a world in the West, in the rich countries of abundance, and we don't know how to deal with that. So we have the diseases of affluence, obesity and waste and climate damage. And we've got to learn to live in a world where we can have what we want, but actually have what is good for us and what fulfills us and not just consume anything that we can do. That's the second transition. The third transition is we've evolved either not needing government because we lived in small groups or in a very kind of hierarchical world where we're told what to do. We want to live in a world where we're self-governing, where we make decisions ourselves. We don't rely on other people to make them for us, but we're stuck in the middle. We're unwilling to be governed, but not yet able to govern ourselves. And I think that's the world that politicians live in. And my answer to that is that we have to reform democracy so that it's much more about people making decisions themselves, taking responsibility for things themselves. And I'm really excited about things like citizens' juries, deliberative democracy, ways of bringing citizens into the room and saying, OK, let's open up the dilemmas to you. Don't just get angry because politicians have to make hard choices. You engage with those choices yourself.
There's so much information flying around now, though, that, yeah, let's not get involved. We'll end up doing a podcast about purely that, because I have questions and opinions on all of those three things you brought up. Let's go back onto your book. Do We Have to Work? Fascinating. Why did you write it?
There's a little reason, a big reason. The little reason is that I've been editing a series for Thomas and Hudson called Big Ideas. And we have these kind of provocative books, you know, should we all be vegans, or is gender dead, or is capitalism finished, whatever. And they're just short, punchy books, 10, 11,000 words of illustrations all around one kind of challenging idea. And after a while, having edited these, I thought, wow, I want to write one myself. And the thing I care about is work. So that was the kind of little reason. The big reason is that there's a lot of talk about work at the moment, Tim, as you know, particularly around COVID, you know, people working from home and people questioning their working lives in all sorts of ways, kind of inequalities in work. And I think what's missing a little bit is a conversation about where do we want to end up? What ultimately would a good work society be like? A society where each of us actually did work that gave us a real sense of fulfillment and meaning and value. And I wanted to write a book that said, okay, if that was our goal, a goal that we didn't spend a third of our adult lives doing something we don't really want to do or doesn't really mean anything to us, what would have to change? How would society have to be different for everyone's work just to be part of how they fully express themselves as a human being? I love the phrase people talk about, work-life balance. What's interesting about that phrase, work-life balance, is it absolutely assumes that your work is not part of your life. You know, your life is the place of meaning and fulfillment and love and engagement, and your work is what you do to pay for shit, right? We've got to get away from the notion of work-life balance and talk about work-life integration, that work is where I live my life, you know? And for some of us, I guess I'm sure it's been you in lots of things that you've done, Tim, and for me, that is how it feels, but it is not how it feels for most people at work.
Yeah, it's a really... fascinating point. Right at the beginning of your book, you talk about what the purpose of life is, and obviously it's to bring income in, but also it's to give you a sense of purpose and derive our status from it too. And I did a podcast with Will Store recently about status, and it is so important. I spoke to an MP from the Northeast once. I had a chat with him, and he said the men are not working. All they want to do, Tim, he says, this is a myth coming from London, as he put it, because that's where obviously Parliament is. The myth that the people in the Northeast don't want to work and they'd rather just take handouts. They want to get up in the morning and have a purpose and have some status and go to work. And it's an important aspect of life, isn't it? Actually, what your job represents in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, that Will Store book, I had him on my podcast as well. It's a fantastic book, although a bit depressing. Didn't you find it a bit depressing, Tim, that idea that we spend our entire life on the kind of status treadmill? But
It really opened my life up. I mean, my world up, sorry, my like your book did. It opened my mind up to why the world is the way it is, because we are just battling for status all the time. You can see it between countries too. You can see Boris meeting Biden and watching that play out, and you can just see it constantly in the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And he explains, and this is always, I think, an important way of viewing the world, that the instincts that we have around status were useful to us, but they don't really fit the modern world. And things like social media, of course, can drive us into complete status madness. So, it was really good. But going back to your question about work, I mean, this is the meaning of work has changed throughout history. And for the first 99% of our time on Earth, work was what we did for subsistence. And there was no separation really between work and the rest of our lives. And as far as we know, we probably worked quite a lot less, because work was to get food and to get shelter and to look after children or older people, the things that we had to do to hold ourselves together. But of course, in those societies, you couldn't accumulate. There was no, you moved around, they were nomadic. So because you couldn't accumulate, there was no point doing anything more than you needed to do. There was no point killing a second mammoth, because it would just rot, so then we move into civilization, as we might call it. We move into more organized societies, around kind of 10,000 years ago, and then in those hierarchical societies, work is really about serving the needs of the elite. It's really about fulfilling the imperial desires of whoever it is led those societies. So a very large proportion.
Can I just ask you a question on that? How did they become elite? Was it generally due to violence, or was there any democracy involved in it at all, do you think?
It varied from place to place, but as societies become more organized, issues arise about control, which you don't have in the same way when you have a small group of people who are related and know each other and can hunter-gatherer group. So once you get into larger societies, A, you have the issue of control, and B, you have the possibility of accumulation. You've got, for the first time, the possibility of people who don't have to work and who can have, you know, 15 mammals, well, that must have gone there, but they can have much more than they need, right? So those two things, the possibility of having more than I need, accumulating, and the need for control, that's what creates, I think, a situation where societies then start to become very hierarchical. So then we work because we have to, and a very large part of work in many of those civilizations is slavery. So basically there is an elite group and they enslave those that they have conquered. And that's a big part of it. And then we move into the kind of a different model, which is various forms of kind of feudal work, where it's not slavery, but it's subsistence work again. And, you know, we had that in our country and in various other places. So you're kind of, you're working then, like life is then defined by your social status. If you are born a peasant, you will stay a peasant and you will do what peasants do and you will have a peasant income and the surplus will go to the lord of the manor or whatever. So that's a particular world. And then you start to see the emergence also alongside that. But, and this has always been part of work of craft, of people who specialize in particular crafts, and that's been there since civilization. But that's another kind of part of the world of work, is those people who are, you know, blacksmiths or doctors or whatever. So there's a set of craft roles that exist, and then around them builds up culture and status associated with that craft. It's meaningful for people. Then you get industrialization. And you get a new pattern emerging, and that really is a pattern of wage labor, where you're not required to work because of law or because of brute force, but you're required to work because of economic necessity. And you have the division between the owners of capital and those who work. And then the final really important change, I think, in that kind of journey, and all of these things overlap, but the final point is consumerism, the rise of consumerism. And a critical moment there is Henry Ford. Because Henry Ford is very, very important to the history of work in two ways. First of all, he automates. He brings in a guy called F.W. Taylor, who breaks down work into the smallest fragments, kind of time and motion studies. So you get this intensification of work and the taking away of control from workers. So workers are on kind of conveyor belts doing exactly what they're told to do. It's a pretty joyless way of working. But the other thing that Ford did was made his cars affordable. And so the deal that Ford, you know, Ford's big deal is your work won't be great, but I'm going to pay you enough, because he paid twice as much as his competitors to buy my cars, because his cars were half as expensive as other people's cars. And that is where we fundamentally end up in the modern world with that deal, which is you don't work for its intrinsic merits. You don't work because it's just what God expects of you or what you're born into. You work to earn. And your fulfillment comes as a consumer in your leisure activity, your family, or the rest. And you work in order to enable that. And that's what leads to this split I was talking about earlier between work and life. And that's worked for us in lots of ways. Don't get me wrong. And most people are okay about their jobs. But it also means that we don't have high expectations. Most of us don't expect work to be truly fulfilling, because in the end, it's there to pay the bills.
Most of us, I suppose, if you look at it, whichever way you look at it, we're hiring out our time, aren't we? That's generally what most people are doing. We'll give you 8 hours, or I'm highly skilled. I'll give you 8 hours for a tenner an hour. I'm really highly skilled, so I'll do it for 100 an hour. I'm a footballer, so I'll do it for £1 million an hour. Whatever it is, that is kind of what you're doing, unless you want to go into the stock market and gamble or something and be a gambler. But you generally, that's what we're all doing, isn't it?
Well, yes, except there's a large part of the workforce that's self-employed, and so they are and broadly speaking, self-employed people earn less and work harder, but they do that for the substantial reward of being their own bosses, and having greater autonomy over how they work.
Yeah, but it's still a contract with yourself, though, isn't it, Matthew? Like, I'm going to put you, you know, if you're self-employed, you still have to contract your time to yourself. Otherwise, you're not going to earn any money.
You do. And there's lots of different types of self-employment. And some people don't choose self-employment. It's the only option available to them. But I think a lot of self-employed people say, well, I do this because I enjoy this activity. This is the thing that I want to do. And I want to be my own boss. And I think that, as I argue in the book, one of the reasons why work isn't fulfilling is control. Because actually, as human beings, we don't like really the idea of being told what to do by somebody else, by sheer dint of the fact that they own the business or they're our manager or whatever. And self-employed people have a trade-off, which is working in more intensively, but being their own boss. And then, of course, there are lots of people who will say that the jobs they do are jobs which they find truly fulfilling, and that if they weren't, you know, even if they weren't paid to do them, they would still want to do them. One of the funny things about us as a society, though, is that the people who do those jobs which look very much like what we would choose to do for each other if we weren't paid, tend to get paid less. Caring. So caring is the biggest and fastest growing part of our workforce. And care, of course, is something we do in the rest of our lives. We're all here because we were cared for by our parents. If we are parents, we've cared for our children. We're probably going to be caring for our own parents and relatives. But yet we also have millions of people who are paid to be carers. And I think sometimes the reason we don't pay carers very much money is we kind of think, well, you're doing something that we all would like to do for our loved ones. So in a sense, it's a labor of love. Well, yeah, but you still got to pay the bills. So right. I think there are lots of different reasons why people work. But it is absolutely the case, as you argue, that fundamentally the biggest reason we work is because we hire out our time and our labor to people on the basis that they can tell us what to do in exchange for giving us money.
People laugh at me, but when I always say this, but you know, if you're a doctor or a nurse or you're in the care system, even though you're not getting paid maybe as much as the guy who works in the city, you get a lot more satisfaction in your life, a lot more purpose. And you can't put a value on the fact that you come home at night and think I've done good rather than just going, I made a few quid.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I work now in an NHS organisation. I think that people who work in caring roles would absolutely recognise that. But I think they would say, look, it's all right that I don't earn as much as a corporate banker, but hey, I need to earn enough to pay the bills. And the problem now is that we've got enormous shortages of staff in caring roles because the system just means that's real poverty wages for those people. So it's not that they... You know, a lot of people will say, I don't want to be rich. I'm happy to be comfortable and do a job that I care about. But what they aren't willing to say is, I love my job, but the consequence of that is I can't put food on the table for my children. And that is unfortunately the case for many, many carers.
Okay. And I think in the pandemic, we saw that key workers, we suddenly saw the fact that actually they're the ones which keep the communities going, whatever fact they are, yet they're the ones not getting paid very much. Capitalism sort of slightly broken in a way. You obviously think a lot about the future and how it is that it seems to me there's more than enough wealth in the world for us all to be quite happy, but it seems to be distributed poorly because of the systems we've got in place. What's interesting is there's lots of people trying to work on a way that we could, not just in taxation, but I suppose global taxation is going to have to be a thing, but people are trying to work out how we can work with universal basic incomes and sort of community credit type systems. How is that faring in the world? I suppose we need to explain what they are first of all, and then work out how we think it is faring.
Yeah, so you're right. There is lots of really interesting experimentation in the world. And in lots of ways, we do things which don't depend on this basic contract that you and I have just discussed, which is I'll do what you tell me to do and you pay me for it, which is rather brutal. And, you know, people share things and people do things out of love. And there are different ways of organizing activity. They're not yet mainstream, a lot of them. And so that's why people talk about things like universal basic income, because they're saying, well, how would we have to change the whole system? And one of the arguments for universal basic income, which is the idea of everybody being paid a subsistence amount of money, enough money to live on, just without having to work, is that it gives people a bit more control. because most of us want to work. Let's be absolutely clear about this. Most of us want to work in the sense that most of us overwhelmingly want to do something useful. We want to make a contribution. We are homo faber. We are, you know, man is a working beast. That's what we are. And we want to do useful work. The idea of universal basic income is that at the moment, because of the way the benefit system works, if you drop out of work or you give up a job you can't bear, you'll lose your benefits and you'll really be destitute. It's better that people have just enough money, not enough money to be rich or anything, but just to survive. So they've got a bit more scope to say, I don't want to do that job. And I'm going to think about trying to find something that is more fulfilling, or I want to get some training so that I can develop and I can grow. That's one of the arguments for a universal basic income. But I think the argument that
Can we just explain universal basic income? How does it actually work? Because they've trialed it in a few places. I think Finland might have trialed it somewhere else where everybody gets a basic income. Is that right? Everybody, whether you're working or not, you get it. So you've got enough money to live. And then if you lose your job, you've still got enough money to live. But the people with work have it too. Is that right? It's not means tested.
And that's exactly a really important point, Tim, which is it's not means tested. So that means you get out of the poverty trap. So what, at the moment, if you're on benefits and you get a job, you lose your benefits, most of them. So you don't actually earn that much extra money if you take a low-paid job. The thing about universal basic income is you keep it if you get a job. And therefore, actually, a lot of people think universal basic income is a reason not to work. It's actually a way to incentivize work because it means that you'll keep the money that you get. You won't lose it in the way that you do benefits. So, yes, that's how it works. And the evidence around the world, and it's been tried in all sorts of places in all sorts of ways, from Alaska to parts of Africa to Finland, is that it generally doesn't make any difference really to people's work incentives. People are no less likely to work. So the idea that it's a license to be lazy is just not true. People are no less likely to work, but it does seem to improve people's well-being. It does seem to make people feel less anxious.
But does it mean there'll be a higher taxation to pay for it?
Yeah, you would need to fund it, and you know there are various ideas about how you might fund it in terms of wealth taxes is one way, or creating a kind of sovereign wealth fund in the way that some countries have got. So there are, yes, and I think anyone who's serious about universal basic income has to have an account of how you pay for it. And you know, the RSA did some very, very detailed work on how you might go about paying for it.
Sorry to interrupt you, Matthew, but while you're on that, I heard once, and you'll obviously know a lot about this because you've been involved in this area. Some of the big economists, I can't remember his name right now. I was listening to a podcast with him, and he was saying it's ludicrous that we've still got income tax when none of the money is with the people anymore. All the money is with the either financial institutions or companies. We need to move the taxation towards them and leave people's money alone because they don't have it. And he's talking about the basic worker. Surely this must have come into your world of thinking, has it?
Yes, it's certainly the case. So the money that we have has two types, income in the form of wages primarily, and then assets, which comes in the form of interests or the accumulation of assets, like when your house doubles in value. And what's happened in the last few decades in particular, and it is a characteristic of capitalism as a system, is that assets have become more and more important in terms of determining people's opportunities, life chances, and inequality. And so society now is as much divided by the assets that we own as by the income that we earn. And if you want to think about this in our own country, if you are living in London and you are on say £40,000 a year job, but you don't own property, you are spending a very high proportion of your money on rent. So you might be in a middle class job like a teacher or a nurse, earning, and you've moved up your profession a bit. So that's not the starting salary. You've moved up two or three rungs in your profession, but you're still things are very difficult for you financially because of the rent you have to pay because you don't own your asset. You might live in a different part of the country and you might earn £25,000 a year, but you own your own home because houses are cheaper. And that house is increasing in value. And so what that's done is one of the reasons we've seen changing voting patterns in our country, and why it is that we have more kind of people in the north, working class people who are voting conservative, and more people who seem to have middle class jobs and middle class incomes voting Labour. Part of the reason for that is because you can be have a higher income, but if you have no assets, you feel poor, or a lower income, but because you own your own house, you feel relatively economically stable. So yes, assets are really changing things. And I think that it was a pity that when the government announced its package for funding social care, it didn't do anything about serious. I mean, it increased tax on dividends. So that's, you know, fair enough. They did do that. But they didn't grasp the nettle of how it is we tax wealth. Because in the end, wealth is also what drives the lack of social mobility, because people like me are able to pass on quite a lot of money to our kids, not because we are multimillionaires, but just because we own a house in London.
Mm.
You know, so taxing wealth is also a way of dealing with inequality in our society.
Mm. But it seems to me that all the companies own all the money now. Just look at Amazon and, let's just look at Amazon. That's a great example. They're making an absolute killing at the moment. And yet they've managed to try and Starbucks, all those guys, they're trying to avoid taxes and they're able to do it. And yet the people are still paying money. It seems like that would solve a lot of problems if we could claw some money back from them and stop people paying taxes. I agree.
And as you said earlier, Tim, there is serious work on this, and the world's biggest think tank, the OECD, should be commended for the fact that it's been working tirelessly for several years to create schemes to tackle this issue of large global corporations not paying their fair share of tax. And there have been reforms that have been agreed. They need to be implemented, and they need, you know, the problem is accountants, and we need accountants, but accountants are very clever people. And when you create one system to try to capture tax, they'll find another way of trying to avoid it. So it's always going to be a game of catch up. But yeah, it is outrageous that some of our largest global corporations don't pay their fair share. And it's good that there is now a much more concerted attempt internationally to do something about that.
Yeah, one of my friends, she works as a lawyer, tax lawyer. She spends her whole time work trying to find loopholes for huge companies. Yep. And I always say that's such an immoral job, you know. And she goes, well, no. And I said, well, what's it like? She goes, well, it's kind of easy because we get paid a lot more money than the government lawyers. So we're the better ones. So we always find the loophole. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, this is mental. Where have we got to a stage with the working world that actually the idea of the big corporations is to see how much money they can collect so they can look at each other? I mean, we keep talking about economic growth. All these things are a bit of a problem, aren't they, if we're trying to build a lovely society?
Yeah, so that takes me to the back to the book, Tim. So as you know, in the book, what I do is I say, what are the things about the way organizations work that make it difficult to imagine a world where we would all have good work? And so the first one, and I arrange these so they're memorable around, they all begin with C. So the first one is control. So it's difficult to imagine a world of good work if we work on the assumption that because I'm your boss, because I own the business or whatever, I can tell you what to do and you have no voice in that and you have no autonomy in that. Autonomy is really one of the most strongly linked things to people's sense of well-being at work. So the main reason that people get miserable at work and sick at work is because they're absolutely no autonomy. They're completely controlled. So the first thing we'd have to do to have a good work society is we'd have to say, in organizations, we organize things so that people do have autonomy and so that they have voice in the decisions that are made, so that those organizations are more democratic. But the second C, which relates to your friend, is competition. Which is, if you work in an organization, and I'm sure you've done this yourself, Tim, you work in an organization where all that people seem to care about is commercial success. That only numbers that matter are we doing better than our competitors? Are we growing? Are we earning more money? Well, you know, no one lies on their deathbed, Tim, and says, I spent my life making a corporation, increasing a corporation's market share or profitability or dividends. We want to feel we're doing something that's got meaning. And it's interesting. I bet you that your friend has been in conversations in her partnership business about the purpose of what they do. I've had really interesting conversations, which have always been top secret, but with very senior, high level corporate lawyers, corporate accountants. And they are beginning to say, look, it's not good enough to say to people, work your bollocks off and you'll be very rich. That's not attracting young people anymore. It's particularly, and women don't seem to be motivated in the same way by that. We need to tell people that yes, you do a great service. Yes, you earn a good salary, but actually you're doing it with a sense of purpose. You're doing something, you're improving the world. And so I think almost all organizations now are having a conversation about that because they're aware of the fact that if you say the only reason we exist is to make money, it's just not good enough. Society won't accept it and the people who work for you won't accept it.
And one of the big things you mentioned there is competition, whether it's money motivated or not. I think it's, I actually said it in the intro, bloody everything has to be a sodding competition, drives me nuts. And if you want to understand that, it's a really good way of understanding it. And it doesn't work anymore, thankfully. But when I started out in TV and for the last probably 5 years it's changed, but before that, the last 20 odd years before that, BBC, which we're paying for, will put programs up against the commercial channels to try and kill their ratings. So, you know, we're paying for it. Why can't we watch all the shows? They put programs up against each other. They're still doing it on Saturday night to try and hurt each other in competition. It's like, well, why can't the viewer watch everything? Why can't you do it so we can watch a bit of everything? Why are you trying to kill each other? And that is just how we perceive the world. And I think I always ask questions, question editors. I always say, why do you do that? Do you know what they do? Sorry, Matthew, to divert.
No, but they
get a schedule and then they all sit in a room looking, going, what can we put up against that to hurt that one? I'm like, why? We're the viewer, we're the consumer. We pay for this bloody thing. And it's like, mental, absolutely.
I remember many, many years ago, Tim, doing a fringe meeting at Tory Party conference. And I was talking to them about the problem of competition as a motivation. And this is an event organized by the FA. And I said to the room, I said, look, let me explain to you the problem of competition, always viewing things through that prism. So I said, most of you in this room, I suspect, would prefer football clubs to cultivate homegrown talent. And to develop and grow their own players, wouldn't you? And they went, oh, yeah. And I said, right, okay. But then if your club, I think Fat Ronaldo was the best player in the world then. I said, if your club bought Fat Ronaldo, you'd be delighted. Mm. You know, so the fact is one part of you has got one set of values, but the other part of you goes, yeah, but I want the best player because I want to win the league. And that's our football mentality. You're right. If people in the media... they got into the media because they're creative. They want to make great things. But a lot of the time, they're just driven by numbers. Because accountants run those organizations. The only thing I would say in the BBC's defense is, I totally get your point, Tim, but I think that when the BBC is at its best, it does popular stuff, but it does it in a way which takes that forward. You know, it does it in a way which then... You know, I don't know, just watching I've got a 9-year-old daughter, so she's a massive Strictly fan. Well, of course, I'm a Strictly fan, but I pretend it's because of her. But, you know, watching it last week and you think, you know, there's a gay couple and there's a woman who's profoundly deaf. And there's something else going on as well as the entertainment, you know, 100%. And that's great. That's great. And the BBC at its best, and I always want to say to people in the BBC, and I do a lot of work with the BBC and it drives me mad, is I always want to say to them, in what way are you a public service broadcaster? Right. It's got to be slightly different because you're a public service broadcaster. And I think the best people in the BBC can answer that question, but some people can't. Anyway, that's a different topic.
In defense of the people who work in TV as well, is you keep your job if you get good ratings, because it goes all the way up to the top and they look down and they look at the ratings and they say, is your show doing well? Yeah. Also with the going back to the football thing, just very quickly, is I always think though, you've got to work out where the money comes from to buy the original Ronaldo, not to actually, you know, yes, you want it, but you've also got, I mean, this is the thing where I'm struggling with as a Chelsea fan. I'm like, where's all the money coming from? And also, we spent £300 million in the middle of a pandemic. I was like, that's quite vulgar, but it means we're probably going to win the league because we're going to buy, like, we bought Lukaku this summer. So, you know, we're up there to compete. So, you know, and it's nice to watch.
So, Tim, I heard a story the other day. You may have heard this story, and you may know whether it's true, but I was chatting to someone who's very, very into, knows his football, the football world and football politics. And he said, because I've been watching that fascinating series on BBC about the Premier League. And he said that when the chairs came together, when they first created the Premier League and they were going to bring all the money in, Alan Sugar said, the problem is all of this money, it's just going to go straight down into the players' wages. It's not going to change anything. It's not actually going to increase the overall, you know, the amount, you know, it's not going to go to the world of football. It'll just come through us into the wages. And he was right. Because how else do you explain the fact that Barcelona and Real Madrid are bankrupt?
Yeah.
They're bankrupt. So what kind of financial system is it where two of the greatest clubs in the world are bankrupt? And they're bankrupt because the only thing you can do with that money is pour it into wages in order that you can compete. So that's another example, I think, of how competition can lead to some very problematic outcomes.
And by the way, knowing what I know about football, a lot of the footballers, even though they want to play at the team to win all the trophies, they also want to be regarded as the highest paid defender in the world, the highest goalie in the world. We earn this much. They like that as well as a way of winning. And what amused me so much was Messi crying, going, I don't want to leave this club. It's the club that I want to know. Why am I leaving? It's like, mate, you've got so much money, you don't have to leave. You could go, I will work for free and you can sell my Messi shirts too, and I won't take a penny for it. And you would have been the biggest hero in football forever to say, I'll play for free for 2 years. He could have done that, but the way the human works is like he's gone to PSG to become the second highest player ever in the world after Ronaldo, who went back to United.
I'm not sure. You know what? And I've often thought this. I think players need to think about where they want to be in their 40s and their 50s. Because, yeah, you can move around and earn as much money as you like. But then, you know, you'll piss that money down the drain or you'll just be bored and rich. The players who, for one reason or another, do stay at clubs, they have a life of being loved by their community. Well, so, you know, if you take, I'm a West Brom fan. So people like Chris Brunt or James Morrison, they will always be heroes at the Hawthorns. They will know they are somewhere they can go back to just because they played at that club for 8 or 9 years. You don't get that if you play 2 years here, 2 years there, 2 years there, 2 years there. So I think players ought to realise there's a bit of a trade-off here. And actually, in your 40s and 50s, if you want to be somebody people continue to look up to, even though you're not a footballer anymore, then staying at one club is a good way to do it.
Well, a very good example of that is F1. I know nothing about Formula One, but what I heard was Alonso, the Spanish rider, went back to Spain and paid taxes. Whereas every time Lewis Hamilton wins over here, everyone goes, well, I don't care because you don't pay taxes. You know, you're not doing this. And then his people come out and say, do you know how many millions of pounds Lewis has paid in taxes? And then the argument is, yeah, it's means tested, so he needs to times that by 10, and then he would be paying what we're paying in comparison to the nurse. That is not the argument, you know. It's like, it means we're all supposed to be paying into the community. And yet, if he just went back to Britain and went, right, I'm paying full taxes here, everyone would be going, holy shit, this is the best guy we've ever had in the planet, you know. And apparently Alonso's treated like, but I don't know enough. So if you're an F1 fan and you're cringing at this, you can write to me and correct me, and I'll put it on the podcast. Just a point going the other way around. My daughter was telling me the other day that she'd gone to JD Sports, and she said she will never go in that shop again because of the staff. And I went, hold on a second, those staff are so, you go to JD Sports and you go to Topshop, they have got horrific owners, right, who only care about making profit. Mike Ashley, as we all know, I mean, like, I don't know him personally, he might be a lovely guy, who knows, but the media perception of him is he only cares about zero hour contracts for his staff. He doesn't give a damn about them. They look miserable, demotivated. I mean, how you can live with yourself like that? You go to Topshop, it's a mess in there, like it's horrible. Again, you've got Philip Green, who doesn't seem to care about anything apart from making money. These guys that seem to be motivated by that, again, I don't know him, so he might be a lovely guy, but he's not come across like that in the media. And you've got to feel sorry for these guys. I just to finish,
Tim,
this
before you yeah go
I did an interview with Bruce Daisley, who you probably know. He did a lovely book about employment. And the point you make in your book as well is, if you actually have an investment, you feel like your work is doing something for the company, it means so much more to actually feel invested in it. These people, they don't give a shit about their staff in these shops, do they? It's like it's a bad place to be employed.
Well, so you've beautifully brought me to my third C. So I talked about control. I've talked about competition. The third C is consumerism. And I think that, you know, the real challenge to your daughter is to say, look, you want to be able to buy really cheap stuff that you can wear for 3 weeks and chuck away and then bring and get something else. Now, there's a consequence of that. You know, if what you care about is price and a kind of throwaway fashion culture, then, you know, you're going to have companies that will pay people minimum wage because they're competing to try to satisfy your needs as a consumer. What you have to ask yourself is, on the one hand, don't you want to be a consumer whose consumption choices align with your values? And secondly, the broader question, which is, why is it in a society we seem to think that our identity is so much more articulated by our consumption choices than our work? So, you know, work is not the place of choice and joy. Shopping is the place of choice and joy. And that's not the way it should be, in my view. I think that work should be much more a place where we feel we have choice and we have control and it's about fulfillment. And consumption should be a place where we show a lot more discipline, where actually we say, no, it's not just about I want it and I want it now and I want it as cheap as possible, but it will be, actually, I'm going to consume things that are good for me, that are good for the planet, that don't involve exploiting other people. So we've got to get away from this. Work is what we have to do. Consumption is what we love doing, and actually have a much more balanced world in which both the world of work and the world of consumption are places where we express ourselves, we have fulfillment, and we have an alignment between what we say we care about and what we do.
I love that. In fairness to my daughter, I've got twin daughters. They did do the whole Topshop thing a few years ago. Now they are obsessed with charity shops or thrift shop shopping, as they
call
it.
Good for them.
But it's been, well, it's become a bit more of an addiction. But it's a very it's a very fashionable thing amongst the young to spend a lot of time in charity shops. So, yeah. Trying to find things which are unique to them, and I love the way that's going. I think
it's much better for the planet. Recycle, reuse. Repair.
Yeah. I want to try and keep this to an hour-ish, and we've got about 10 minutes left. A couple of topics I'd love to talk about, though.
Can I do my fourth C, Tim? Please. So these are the things that are stopping us having a world where work is great for everybody. Control, too much a focus on competition, too much an assumption that consumerism is where our identity and joy lies. The fourth one is cognitive bias. Sounds like a bit of jargon. What do I mean by cognitive bias? I mean that nearly all the best jobs in our society are associated with types of thinking skills. Yeah. So accountants and lawyers and managers and professionals of various kinds. And these are alongside care. That's also a fast growing kind of group of people. We don't value work of the heart. So this is work of the head. And the best paid jobs are all head work of the head. What about work of the heart? We've got to value work of the heart, caring work, basically, much more. We talked about that earlier. And also, we've got to value manual work much more. And as a society, as you know, we're really bad at this. Other cultures like Germany give much greater status and rewards to skilled engineering and those kinds of things. It might not be manual in the sense of oily rag, but they're about, you know, concrete, real world, physical things. Now, I made this point a few months ago very, very badly because I was on an Australian show and I said, we've got to not just give value to jobs of the head, but we've also got to give more value to jobs of the heart and more value to hand jobs. So that was a very big, that was a really big mistake that I made. But the cognitive bias thing is important. As long as we in the society say it's only these types of jobs with these kinds of skills that are high status, high paid, that's not going to help, because actually we've got, you know, as we all know, in the crisis, in COVID, we needed carers, we needed delivery drivers, you know, we needed plumbers, we needed nurses, corporate bankers, not quite so much. So we just need a society which is which has multiple ways of acknowledging people's contribution.
You can always, I'm going to move. You've actually commented on my point I was going to make, but just before that, it always amused me during the Brexit argument. By the way, whether you hate me or not, I voted Remain, and I don't hate people who voted Brexit. But one of the arguments for all my very left-wing friends were against Brexit was, and it always astounded me this, but what about all the Eastern Europeans who come over and the Portuguese and stuff who come over and do all the jobs that we don't want to do? And I was just like, what? And they were like nurses and builders and cleaners. And I was always like, yeah, you could always pay people more money. There'll be, there's always a basic economics. If you're going to pay someone £1 million, they'll clean your house for you. You know, it always amused me that the idea is that where's our cheap labor? And they're all the jobs that we found out during the pandemic that we all suddenly went, hold on, we need nurses, don't we? And we need people to work in hospitality. Mm. We've lost all our hospitality. All the people in hospitality are going, and I don't blame them because they've worked out their business again. We haven't got anyone. My daughter went for 9 jobs and got offered 5. And I said to her, just phone up all 5 of them and say, double my money and I'll come and work for you. It's a supply and demand thing.
Yeah, no. Well, it's really interesting, Tim. So actually that argument that Brexiteers made does seem to have some validity to it, which is that because we've got a shortage of staff, people are having to pay more. You know, I was just reading the other day about John Lewis increasing the wages for HGV drivers for precisely that reason. So actually, I'm a Remainer as well. I think lots of the Brexit arguments were complete nonsense. But that argument, which is actually if we have fewer immigrants, we'll have to pay people more, it's got some validity to it, and it does seem to be happening. However, it goes back to our point about meaning. The thing about those Eastern Europeans was that they had a strong sense of meaning, which was about giving opportunities to their families. And it's very similar to, earlier generations of migrants who come here, who often work incredibly hard. They live in bedsits, crowded bedsits. It's not anything you'd want to do, but it has meaning for them because they believe that they are creating opportunities and possibilities for their families. And they're escaping from the world that they may have developed, come in, before the Berlin Wall fell. So for them, there's this sense that you get from migrant communities of enormous meaning because you're creating a possibility for the next generation. Mm. I don't think many people in Britain have that same sense now. That's kind of gone to an extent. And I think even when we pay people more, if you don't have that sense, you've got to think about the design of the job, because you might pay people more, but if the job is still not a great job, you're still being told what to do. There's no sense of autonomy. There's no sense of meaning. You're being bullied and pushed around. You still don't want to do it. And that's why we've got these staff shortages are partly to do with the migrant issue, but they're partly to do with people saying, I just don't want to do a crap job. Thank you very much. You know, I'd rather be poor.
Yeah.
The
other side to that, one of my friends, he runs a couple of bars. He's had to really up his barman's wages. I mean, they're getting paid. I can't remember what he said now, and I don't want to quote the wrong figures. But the wages he said, I went, well, that's good. And he goes, well, I have to, otherwise everyone's going to steal them. And I thought, well, that's great the way that's worked. So a barman now, a head barman, is now getting much more value, and I thought that's good. He needs him for his business. But the other thing is, my daughters who spent the whole of the summer working in hospitality, they're at university now. There's not a chance they worked a lot of hours, by the way, because they wanted to get some money back to pay for their university, which I really appreciate them for doing. I think it's great. But they were like, there's not a chance they could afford to live on that. They couldn't, as you mentioned earlier, they couldn't afford. They would have to live however many to a house. So so I hate the argument when they go, British people won't do it. Of course they won't, because they can't afford to live on it. You know, you have to get 3 people to a bedroom to do it on those wages. So we need to rethink how the wages work, maybe. And I know people will be sitting there going, it's easy for you to say because you work on TV, and it is, because I do have a good job, but it's just the thought processes we need to go through and make sure we're not being ignorant about how much it costs to actually live in London.
We've got to think about the cost of living, and we don't build enough houses, and we haven't developed the economies of other parts of Britain enough. So we always have an overheating London and the southeast, where you have to be really, I mean, you look, and if you don't own your own house, you have to earn a lot of money in London to have a comfortable lifestyle, so no, you're absolutely right. I mean, on this meaning issue, I'm often reminded of a story that a guy called Richard Sennett wrote in a wonderful book he wrote about work. he found himself sitting on a plane next to a global executive who worked for one of the big consultancies. And this guy basically had a miserable life. He was rich, but he spent most of his life flying around the world. He felt alienated from his family. He didn't really feel his job was meaningful. He was just trying to make as much money as he could for the consultancy. And then Sennett found out this guy was the son of someone he knew really well. And the person he was the son of was the guy who used to be the janitor in the toilets at Richard Sennett's university. And this guy, who was a migrant, was one of the happiest people he ever knew. And the reason he was happy was because he was building the opportunity for his son.
Right.
You know, brilliant. And also yeah. because he was a nice guy and people in the toilets would give him a, you know, leave a few dimes and would chat with him and stuff. So actually he quite enjoyed the kind of human interaction. He was doing something of immediate value to people, which was making sure their visit to the restroom was nice. But it was interesting that meaning is a really important part of this, and meaning has got lots of different qualities. And some people will do work that's really tough and really backbreaking if they feel they're creating opportunities for their children. But if you're a young person now and you don't feel you're creating opportunities for your children because you can't save up, exactly as you say to him, you can hardly pay your rent, then why work at a job that has no meaning, that gives you no autonomy, that has no future, just so that you can get stressed out and then spend all that money on rent?
It's really better
to stay at home with your parents and watch daytime TV. That's not a great world, you know.
Exactly. My intro into this is really apt for this whole conversation, because I was thanking the sponsor, because I don't make money out of this podcast, but it's just I do it because I love meeting and talking to people like you. I get so much satisfaction out of it, unfortunately I have another job that pays me and allows me to do this. Right, are you okay for time, because I've got two more questions and I can see
I'll answer questions. Them really briefly, Tim.
Right, well the first question is which I sort of got from your book, but I started reading it a while ago, so I can't remember how it's actually worded, but we've sort of created in the good old days it was like, I'm going to dig a hole, or I'm going to put a shoe on a horse, or I'm going to bake some bread. Now we've invented jobs, which you talk about, which are the jobs of the mind. We've created, haven't we, just this mass amount of jobs. I sit in one of those, what do you call them, workspaces, and everyone in there, no one's actually making anything or doing anything. All they're doing is sitting, coming up with ideas. We've created this mass of jobs like marketing, which actually is a fake job. We've created, it's not a fake job because it has a purpose, or law. Law can be brilliant, but it also can be just a stupid game they're playing out with each other, you know. So there's a lot of these jobs we're creating which actually don't have that much substance to it. We've created mass of them, haven't we?
It's a really, it's something I think about a lot. And there's a book that is very famous, is quite a lot about this, a book by a guy called David Graeber, who sadly died, called Bullshit Jobs.
TV every weekend.
So his book starts from a corporate lawyer who says to him, I'm rich, I live in a flat in Manhattan, but you know, if I didn't exist, it wouldn't make any bloody difference to anybody, you know. So I think you're right. What we do about it, I don't know, because it's what makes the world go round, is this. And we do live in a complicated world where we don't just bake bread and shoe horses and stuff like that. We live in a world where you need people who can do computer jobs and law jobs and accountancy jobs. But I do actually think, and it's not something I've thought deeply about, if we could find a way of simplifying the world, it would be a good thing. We create, and actually, you know, Tim, we gave a really good example of this earlier on, didn't we? Which is, you have a tax system, and the tax system started off hundreds of years ago and having three taxes or whatever, and it was all very simple. And now the tax code is telephone directories long. And then we have to invent a whole group of people who are tax lawyers, because those tax lawyers are going to know that directory and give you advice about how to avoid your taxes. And then we got to have tax people who work for HMRC who are making sure that you do pay your taxes, and to have to constantly try and catch up with the tax lawyers and the accountants who are making the changes. So you're quite right. You could take that whole world and just say, well, if we made the tax system much, much simpler, we wouldn't need so many accountants, because everyone would understand how it worked. It'd be much more difficult to cheat, so we wouldn't need people chase. So yeah, I don't know how we do this as a society, but yeah, it would be great if we could simplify things. And also, going back to the consumer point, sometimes we should say, why do we actually need this thing? And this is years ago, I know, but I had this moment I was standing in a Comet. I don't know if Comets even still exist, actually. I was standing in a Comet, and the person in front of me was buying a digital photo frame. So that was a photo frame that you could plug in, and it would show the pictures moving around. I thought, couldn't we just say no? It's ugly, it's going to use energy, and it's much nicer to have just a photograph, but everyone's going to buy this bloody digital picture frame, and they will sit in people's front rooms completely distracted because there's this rolling series of photographs of them on their skiing holidays. So maybe one thing we need to do is also just say, just because it's an innovation, just because it's new, no, we don't need it. No, thanks. Fortunately, digital photo frames never took off. So.
Yeah, some of the technology advances are great, and some are absolutely appalling. My e-bike I love because I can get around really quickly, yeah. and I never use my car anymore. But my phone I absolutely hate, and my mates take the mickey out of me because I got rid of it and got a light phone, which is a phone which doesn't do anything. And I said to them, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to commit. And then after a week, they went, where's your light phone? I said, it doesn't do the things I want it to do. Yeah. Right. My final question, because it's the big one that always comes up and it is important, is technology, robots. Do you think they're going to be stealing our jobs in the future? Or, I mean, obviously they're helping us in various different ways, but will they be you do a good bit in your book actually about how vacuum cleaners came along on washing machines and domestic appliances and how that completely revolutionized the amount of work we have to do in the home. I suppose we've kept moving since then, and we've just talked about technology there. Is it going to take away a lot of our work, do you think?
No, it will change the nature of our work, but it won't take it away. As I said, for example, caring is the fastest growing area of the labor market. And there are some caring robots in Japan and places, but you know, care is going to be done, something that is done by human beings. There's a lot of hype here. When I was at the RSA, because we did events, I wish I'd actually insisted on this, but I wasn't that kind of manager. But I said to our fantastic events team about 7 years ago, could we do an event every year called 5 years to driverless cars? And what I want to do is every year we do an event called still 5 years to driverless cars, because I was being told 8 years ago it's 5 years to driverless cars, and they're nowhere near. They're still not. And I think it's a generation and maybe even longer that will have driverless cars, especially in cities. So there's a lot of hype we have to avoid. But the actual story is that if you meet one set of human needs, another set of human needs emerges. And, you know, there are jobs now which didn't, you know, how many people now are masseurs? 20 years ago, the only people who were masseurs 20 years ago were people who were physiotherapists and people who were sex workers. Now there's thousands and thousands of masseurs because we've got a bit of money and, oh, I'd like a massage. So that's not going to be done by robots. Or the other story, Tim, is very briefly, is the music industry. So when... You know, you'll remember when, you know, people first started kind of downloading, people said it's the end of the music industry. We've lost our value proposition. Everyone's going to download music for free. You know, what actually happened was that the music industry pivoted. And instead of, when I was a kid, the Rolling Stones made a record, went on tour to sell the record. Now bands make music and put it free in order that they can sell tickets to their gig. And so music has become much more about the experience of, you know, when I was a kid, there was one festival or two festivals in the whole of Britain. There's now thousands of festivals, despite our weather. So what happened with music is that when technology made it very difficult to make money out of the content, instead, we moved to a model where people make money primarily out of the live experience. And that will happen in other sectors. If technology comes along, there'll be free labor, there'll be more money, and people will develop new needs, and we will get, you know, you walk down a high street now and it's not a greengrocer's and it's not a hardware shop, it's a masseur, it's a nail bar, it's whatever, it's a new type of men's barbers or whatever. That will just develop. And so I don't think there's any reason why ultimately there's a shortage of jobs. So that's the wrong question to be asking, is will there be jobs in the future? The right question to be asking is, will there be jobs that make us happy?
Right. Okay. I'll pick up on a couple of things there. The Rolling Stones, when a few years ago, maybe 20 years ago, they released an album and said, we're not touring this album, we're just doing videos, which always made me laugh. And that was at the peak music history, where they just made money for old rope out of any old stuff. They'd gone to CD, I think, and were just charging a fortune for a bit of plastic. I saw a driverless bus in Norway. I was in Stavanger last week, 2 weeks ago. I saw a driverless bus there, and I said, why is there a man in it? And they said, because he's not, it's not allowed to be driverless unless there's a man in it in case it goes wrong, which made me laugh a lot.
That's brilliant.
So it's not driverless then. They went, well, it is, because he doesn't do anything, but he's got to make sure it doesn't go wrong. And finally, Kate Darling, who you might know or not know, she's written a book about robots. I'm interviewing her on my podcast soon. When I asked her, she was on my Sunday brunch show. When I asked her about Bill Gates saying we should be taxing robots in the future, she said, and I thought this was fascinating, I picked up on it and everyone looked at me like I'm mental. She said, all his computers and his software have got rid of a lot of jobs. Surely we should be taxing Bill Gates. And I suddenly went, hold on a second. Maybe that's what we should be doing, looking at software, which is taking over from work. Maybe we should be taxing that. Maybe that is something we should be looking at if we're going to tax robots.
No, we need to
claim the money back from somewhere. Why can't it come from algorithms?
Your earlier point, Tim, about taxing corporations properly is absolutely right. But it's just, I just don't, you know, because I've studied the history of work, I can tell you that for 200 years, people have been saying technology is going to mean there's less work, and there's actually more work and more people in work than there ever has been before in successful economies. So it's really not about the amount of work. There will always be work to be done. To go back, I mean, I'm not obsessed by massage, by the way, but, you know, in a perfect world, I would have a massage every week. I would have a therapy session every week. I'd have a foreign language tuition every week. I'd have a personal instructor every week. I could employ, I mean, rich people do it. Rich people employ 20 people to meet their various needs. So, you know, if the economy was successful enough, we'd just all be employing each other to make us feel better. So there's not a problem about the amount of work, right? The problem is the quality of work. And it's been great to talk to you about that.
All right. Final thing, and really just quick answers. Is universal basic income working? Because we mentioned it and we didn't quite get to the conclusion. Do you think that's going to be the future?
I do. I think there are lots of different ideas about universal basic income. And there's some ideas which are completely, I think, unrealistic, that a universal basic income be at the level where we could all have, you know, a wonderful life on it. I don't think that. I think a much more modest universal basic income, which is basically a benefit system where you don't lose benefits where you are allowed to give up your job if it's not a good job that's fulfilling for you or got a future, in order to retrain or take a bit of time, and where you don't lose your benefit when you get a job, so you get rid of the poverty trap. A much more modest universal basic income, the evidence around the world is it does work. And it does improve people's quality of life. So, yes, I think it will come, but, you know, it will take time. And but there are sufficient experiments around the world. And broadly speaking, those experiments have been successful.
It's been fantastic talking to you, Matthew. Your podcast, what's it called?
It's called Bridges to the Future.
Okay. And
I'm interviewing later today? I'm interviewing a forensic psychologist who's written a book about the people she's worked with, including murderers and victims of, I mean, you know, it's an amazing book. So you should read that. That's a great book.
I met a forensic expert not so long ago, and he said to me, I said, tell me, so I like meeting people and saying, tell me things I know. He goes, I'll tell you something we know. All those TV shows, we're nowhere close to get. Oh, no, it's different, is it? What does this person do?
So she's a forensic psychiatrist. So she worked in Broadmoor. She worked with some very, very disturbed and difficult, difficult people. But it was a fascinating, it's not the kind of book I would normally read, but it was fascinating.
Right. Well, this forensic expert, I said to tell somebody, you know, he said, everyone's got the ability to kill someone. There you go.
That's one of the arguments she makes. Great. On that cheerful note, Tim.
If people want to follow you, where do they go?
My Twitter handle is at FRSA Matthew.
FRSA.
The book is called Do We Have to Work? And the podcast is called Bridges to the Future. And it's been great, Tim. Thanks so much.
Lovely speaking to you. Thank you so much.